Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, if you've been following the Banking Royal Commission, it's hard to know whether to be shocked, saddened, outraged, or all of those at once and then some. It does seem like our worst fears are being confirmed on a daily basis by the evidence that's being adduced. The matters being uncovered are terrible tales of unwitting ordinary Australians being robbed of their retirement future by terrible advice from big corporations only with their own interests at heart, or financial planners with, again, selfish intent only, of deliberately lying and deceiving the corporate regulator, and quite possibly now criminal charges to be applied in the case of AMP, for example. You ask yourself, do the people involved in those acts have no conscience at all, or have they found some way of removing their own sense of serving humanity from their workplace? And certainly not everybody who works in finance or the banking sector is part of that. But is there a culture within that industry of separating the two domains of their life that leads to these terrible outcomes? In fact, that's exactly the question asked by Professor David Kinley, who holds the chair in human rights law at the University of Sydney. Recently, he released a book, and just in the last couple of weeks, Necessary Evil: How to Fix Finance by Saving Human Rights. I spoke with David Kinley about his view that banking is losing its sense of serving the community.
Many people, or at least I, can remember the days when it was boring banking. It was something in which you did know your bank manager. You had a much more personal relationship with those who were in charge of your finances. But now, with a combination, of course, of the internet and computerization, you've got a financial system that is very much removed. I mean, I would suggest that most people that are listening here hardly ever see anyone in their bank. Everything is done electronically or a hole in the wall, and I agree there is an element in that that means you can distance any problems. Some of the stuff that we're seeing coming out of the Banking Royal Commission at the moment, I would suggest that many of the people there who are giving evidence aren't necessarily bad people, but the system that they've been introduced to and the demands that it makes of them and the incentives that it puts in front of them have made them act in ways that, frankly, are horrifying. They're certainly antisocial. One of the most interesting parts of the book, actually, was to look at the ways in which other disciplines look at finance. I'm a human rights lawyer, but I looked at behavioral economists and psychologists, and some of them have done remarkably interesting and simple and very telling experiments showing how people who enter a financial system, our current financial system, are not necessarily more corrupt or more inclined to cheat. But when they're put in their financial mode, they're thinking about work, experiments show that they will be more ready to cheat than those who are just thinking of their home life. That spells bad for an industry.
And is that because at some stage, and I wonder when that was, we flipped and we said, well, our objective here is to maximise shareholder value, not necessarily a bad thing, but we're going to put our ethics or our sense of personhood, we're going to put our human rights hats to one side.
Finance has become such an important part of the modern economy, and it's certainly the case with Australia. It's now our biggest industry, our wealthiest and most powerful industry, that it's able to dictate a lot of what happens within the economy, politics and society. Don't touch us, because if you do, you might endanger the whole system. And indeed, we saw this writ large with the global financial crisis.
Yes. This idea that they're too big to fail, so
yeah, and therefore
whatever's happened, the taxpayer will bail them out, the government will bail them out.
Yeah, and there are going to be ups and downs, but the ups, remember, are always very good. The problem is that on the ups, those who are financially wealthy and astute do well, those who are wealthy and financially wealthy and astute when there's a down will also do well if you have a bailout from the government. So I think what's happened is that there's been a sort of, I call it an exceptionalism, that finance believes itself to be such an important industry, to be so exceptional and different from others, that it should have different rules and be treated in a different way, and hence this idea that it must be saved. Other industries can be left to go to the wall. Car manufacturing in Australia is a classic example, and in the United States, but not finance. Now, I'm not suggesting we let finance go to the wall, but one has to look at what the consequences are of inappropriate, imprudent, or indeed even corrupt action. And that's the very question that's going to face our politicians and indeed our regulators if and when, when this Royal Commission winds up.
Our guest on Open House is Professor David Kinley. He's the author of a book, Necessary Evil, How to Fix Finance by Saving Human Rights. And I know that you didn't write this with the Royal Commission in mind. In fact, it was coincidentally just published in the United States in the last week or so. But, well, the coincidence is stark, and we can't help but say that this is a great time to be asking this question, David. So draw the link between human rights and finance.
Well, this is an interesting one. As a lawyer, one tends to always look at the legal articulation of human rights in domestic documents like human rights acts or anti-discrimination acts, or even more ethereal, the international human rights law conventions. But in fact, the point that I push and I explore in this book is to say, in fact, human rights is better understood by the sorts of things that you and I and everyone who's listening seek in their lives and for their children and for their families and friends and for everyone around them every day. A certain degree of security, of dignity, of respect, of safety, of fairness, of treating others as you would want to be treated yourself. These are the sorts of things that underpin what human rights say in these legal articulations.
Yes.
And it's that I think, once you establish that makes you realize how important finance is. I'm not saying that if you're rich, you therefore have a better life. It's more that there are certain things in life that do require a degree of funding. Our schools, whether you go to a private school or whether you go to a public school, that requires funding either from the government or from yourself. The same with health, the same with our housing, the same with our courts and the fair trials that we would enjoy in countries like this. So that, I think, is where you sort of break down this esoteric legal language to see what human rights actually mean in practice. And then I think one is able to readily understand the link between finance and those elements of the good life.
Well, I think what you've drawn for us is the picture of the missing link. And people who listen regularly to our program Open House know that what we like to do is to point to things that can work redemptively in our community. So to restore what's broken. Clearly, the Royal Commission has shown that the banking industry is broken. It's not serving those human rights needs. It's not serving the people that it was set up to serve. It may be serving the shareholders, but I suspect most shareholders are horrified to think they've invested in these organisations. And now they're paying the price. Of course, the share prices are dropping. But here it is. So how can we restore? Your book promises to save the situation. Can you talk about instances where finance, a healthy finance industry, can actually work in this restorative, repairing way?
Well, I can. Just before I indicate examples, and indeed I think there are many, and that's why I think finance is so important and must be saved. Hmm. One has to say that we're not yet at the point where the banks are being forsaken, at least not by shareholders. It may come, but the share prices are not showing a distinct drop. AMP is an exception for perhaps exceptional reasons, but not the rest of the banking sector, which I think points to an issue that is actually societal-wide. The banks have leveraged themselves. They've binged on debt in such a huge way that even a small mispricing of some of their investments can bring the banking sector to its knees, just as we saw in the global financial crisis. Now, the reason for that is because there are enough customers, both corporate clients and us, who want to take on that sort of debt. So we too, and I think you'd agree, compared to our parents, and certainly compared to our grandparents, are mired in debt in a way that they would just simply find unconscionable.
So, well, yes, the temptation to borrow 100% or 110% to finance our new house plus furniture. We're partly responsible.
And so we've got to ask ourselves the questions of, you know, are we ready to let this go? We're not. We don't want to see it sink, but we do want to see it act in a way that is more responsible and more fair, that the distribution of its largesse is broader and fairer, which brings me to the question that you asked. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no doubt when you look at the figures for global poverty and indeed poverty within countries, most people think that perhaps poverty hasn't changed much in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years. In fact, it has changed almost immeasurably. We've gone from a situation where in the 1980s, 40% of the world lived in abject poverty. 40% of the world's population. Now it's less than 10%. Even more startling, and it's not just finances that has done this, but it has been a big part. In China, in 1981, nearly 90% of people lived in abject poverty. Now it's less than 2%. I mean, that's quite an extraordinary turnaround. There may be all sorts of other human rights problems in China, but that is one that indicates how finance can contribute to an economy, which then helps individuals personally, directly, and their state to lift all boats. Now, it doesn't do it fairly, because China actually now has a distribution problem akin to the West. They have very nearly as many billionaires as the United States now. They soon will overtake it. And there are huge disparities in wealth in both China and Europe and particularly in the United States. And that disparity, I think, has got to a point, this is what Thomas Piketty's argument is in his book, has got to a point where it's unconscionable and people are rebelling against it, feeling this is unfair. Yes, you can be rewarded for your investment, your intelligence, your risk, but not to such an egregious degree when other people still are starving or still are poor. And I think it's that distribution metric that we're going to see a lot of focus on now to try and make finance fairer in the way in which it carves out the pie.
David Kinley is our guest on Open House, Chair in Human Rights Law at University of Sydney, and the author of this book, Necessary Evil. Well, let's go to that question then. If we only got stiffer penalties from the wash-up to the Royal Commission, we would not go anywhere near the sort of change in thinking, restoring the balance that you've just spoken about and which I long for, and I'm certain people listening to this program do as well. How do we incentivize our elected representatives to work in a way that they'll produce a regime? Is it possible to produce a regulation regime that builds within it this role that finance can have in restoring human dignity?
Oh, yes. I mean, for sure. Hope is something that human rights people do. They have to. And there is no, it's more than hope. I think it's absolutely possible. It's just that it's this. I think it will take time. Like any of these big cultural shifts, it will take a generation, if not more. It won't be done by simply re-regulating the regulators. Giving ASIC more power and getting ASIC to enforce will not be the will not itself achieve the desired results. It's necessary. It certainly will send a message. But I think perhaps even more important than what the regulators are doing and what politicians are providing those regulators is the message about what finance ought to be, to sort of change it from within, because financiers can be, should be, are our friends, relatives, people we know, people we see on the television, people we hear on the radio, and surely they too have their sisters, brothers, mothers, fathers, etc., who they want to be proud of what they're doing. And I have no doubt whatsoever that the idea of finance now being an attractive area to go into will take a hit. And that, I think itself, it may seem somewhat infinitesimal or ephemeral, but I think that sort of notion of where you want to conduct your life, how you want to conduct your life as a job, will be an important player in what finance does in the next two or three decades, or certainly in the next decade.
Well, I hope so, and I hope that young people who are thinking about a career in finance might say to themselves, why am I doing this? Well, I'm doing it not for personal wealth or gain or to be Gordon Gekko or any of those things, but because I want to contribute to the well-being of my neighbour.
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, again, but part of the book, I was reading this marvellous anthropologist who was looking at the anthropology of Wall Street. And she was identifying the fact that in the 80s, a huge percentage of Ivy League schools, whether they were law or business, it didn't matter. It could have been anthropology, were heading towards Wall Street and the City of London because that's where it was considered you could make a pot of gold, and it was not considered immoral. Some people may have, but generally it was seen as a quite appropriate way in which to conduct oneself. I don't think that's necessarily the case anymore post the global financial crisis, and indeed in Australia what we're seeing at the moment. As you mentioned earlier, this book was launched in the US, and I was over there for 2 or 3 weeks at the time, and most of the talks I were doing were to young people at universities and think tanks. And I've got to say that alongside the fact that the current administration in the United States has created a real political literacy amongst the young in the United States, part of that literacy has pushed them towards thinking about all sorts of aspects of their policy, which includes things like the fairness of their economic system, the way in which the banks seem to have got right back to where they were very quickly after the global financial crisis, and the disparities in wealth, avoiding of taxation by big corporations. Those sorts of things seem inappropriate, and I could see amongst the people there, and I've seen it here amongst our students in Australia, a much less keenness to go into finance and a greater idea of trying to contribute to society rather than simply to themselves.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you for trying to inspire a new generation, and thank you for the work you've done on this book. Professor Kinley, it was great speaking with you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
Professor David Kinley is the Chair in Human Rights Law at the University of Sydney. He's the author of Necessary Evil, How to Fix Finance by Saving Human Rights. And that was published by Oxford University Press last month in the US. It'll be released in Australia and elsewhere in the world in May 2018. David Kinley. And I meet students, some of them law students, some of them from Sydney University, who do actually have that zeal to go and change the world. I just think it's so important that we do try to instill in our young people, particularly young Christians, who must look at things like the Banking Royal Commission and other royal commissions, who must look at the world and say, how can I make a contribution to such a messy place? Well, I think we're called to clean it up. I think we're called to be different, to be the difference that Christ allows us to be. And finance is a great place. I had that exact conversation with a young person in a church. It was an evening talking about vocation, maybe 10 years ago. And we had that exact contribution. The person put up their hand and said, I want to be in the banking sector, finance sector. I can't see any connection between my faith and what I want to do at work. And there's the antidote. There's the answer. Professor David Kinley has the answer. And just as an aside, I did enjoy talking to David Kinley about changes in the banking industry over the years. You know, Andy Crouch mentioned that the finance revolution was one of the great revolutions that he said started the depersonalization of our community. That podcast is up now on our podcast page, openhousecommunity.com.au. This was the decoupling of a means of exchange from things that were tangible, either your land or a mineral that you could exchange, or your own labour that you could exchange. And I was chatting with David Kinley about the marketplace. If I have eggs and you have wheat, I can exchange my eggs for your wheat. And I'm sure you've had the experience of going to, say, a wet market in the developing world, where people are directly selling their own produce and they're exchanging with each other. You tend to have a strong sense of community about that. When the banking industry comes along, it makes a different means of exchange possible. So now my eggs can purchase me or can be exchanged for a coupon, effectively, coins or you know, money in some form, from a bank, from a finance sector, that then allows me to go and buy a house or something other that's you know, not tangible. So I can now trade with people, not just in my own village, but in different parts of the world. That's a good contribution that it makes, but I think it's certainly less personal than when my eggs and your wheat are part of the same ecosystem. And if we have a bad season, we all have a bad season together. That's when you've got a human understanding. And I did visit with Samaritan's Purse when I was in Cambodia, a small microfinance operation where members of the community would put their own money into a safe deposit box, and it was held by the village chief, and they had a finance committee of the village. And you signed a pledge to say that you would contribute, you know, whatever, however many real it was going to be a month or whatever you could manage, and you deposited your money into this community fund. Members of the same community would then come to the committee and say, I need to buy more food for my pigs. Can I borrow from the community fund and I'll repay it back at an interest rate of 1% or 2%. It was a very nominal interest rate. And get this, members of the community committee would vote on whether that was a worthwhile thing for you to borrow money for. So if you came and said, you know, I'm going to go down to the pub and spend it all on the poker machines, the committee would say to you, that's not a good use of our community resources. No, you can't borrow that. But if you said, I want to improve the value of my crop and that'll bring extra wealth into the village, well, then they all have a stake in it. It's that sense, if we could just capture somehow that sense of we're all in this together, that's the antidote to what we've seen playing out at the Royal Commission.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.